Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Psalms chapter 44. We will entitle this psalm, Come to Our Help. The heading of the psalm says this, For the director of music of the sons of Korah, a Maskil. The sons of Korah were a choir of Levites that King David had appointed to serve in the temple worship, so they were in charge of worship, and this was a psalm that was probably used in temple worship, a song. They were descendants of the famous Korah, whose rebellion was written about in Numbers 16, when the ground opened up and the earthquake swallowed them alive into the ground. Korah, of course, had rebelled against Moses' leadership, but at least the sons of Korah didn't let their tainted ancestry get in the way of them serving in the temple. Now, the first 8 verses I'm just going to read straight through, because the interpretation of them is obvious. However, there is an ambiguity on the word them. Most people say the them belongs to the Israelites, not the Canaanites, but the Israelites. So as we read through there, I will assume that. It is controverted, but I'm going to assume it. And we'll read, starting with verse 1, O God, we have heard with our ears, our fathers have told us, the work that you did in their days, in the days of old. You with your own hand drove out the nations, then you planted them. The them there is you planted the Israelites. You afflicted the peoples. That's the Canaanites. Then you spread them abroad. I'm assuming that's the Israelites. You spread them. For by their own sword they did not possess the land, and their own arm did not save them. But your right hand and your arm and the light of your presence, for you favored them. You are my king, O God. Command victories for Jacob. Through you we will push back our adversaries. Through your name we will trample down those who rise up against us. For I will not trust in my bow, nor will my sword save me. But you have saved us from our adversaries, and you have put to shame those who hate us. In God we have boasted all day long, and we will give thanks to your name forever. Selah. Verse 1, the psalmist says, O God, we have heard with our ears all the work that was done in the days of old. Well, how had the Israelites heard with their ears? Well, a couple of options. They could have heard all of God's great works with the Israelites by tradition, passed down from father to son. As we read in Exodus 10, verse 2, And that you may tell in the hearing of your son and of your grandson how I made a mockery of the Egyptians and how I performed my signs among them, that you may know that I am the Lord. So it could be a literal hearing with the ears as the stories are passed down, but it also could refer to having heard Moses and the prophets read, the earlier prophets read, and so that's how they heard. Now, as to when this psalm took place, of course, we don't know because no time indicators are given. It could have been quite late, actually, all the way up to the Babylonian captivity. So, however they heard. The Jews have a strong and endurable tradition. In verse 2, the psalmist says, God drove out the nations, then planted them. Now, if you'll look at the literary structure here, you've got, you drove out the nations, and then under that, you've got, then you planted them. That's referring to the Israelites. So nations is line A, Israelites line B, then line C, you afflicted the peoples. That's the Canaanites. And then line D, you spread them abroad. That is the Israelites. Well, now you might ask, how are the Israelites spread abroad? This is where the controversy comes in, because you could say that refers to the peoples who were spread abroad as they were defeated by God, which is the context of the first 8 verses. Well, you could say the Israelites were spread abroad in the sense that they came into Canaan and they spread over all the land and they took it over. So that's how I would answer that problem. So that's how you resolve that ambiguity of who the pronoun them refers to. And then the psalmist in verse 3 modestly says it was not by the Israelites' might and character that they won their victories, for by their own sword they did not possess the land. In other words, by the Israelites' own sword, they didn't possess the land, and their own arm did not save them. In other words, they didn't win by the arm of the flesh. But on the contrary, it was your, God's, right hand and your arm and the light of your presence that won the battles and won the land. For you favored them. So we see this is a prayer to God, a psalm that's sung to God. Verse 4, You are my king. Notice it was we in verse 1, and now in verse 4 is you are my king. Not consistent with the pronouns. I don't know if that means anything, but it's just something to note. Command victories for Jacob. Of course, Jacob is the other name for Israel, and both of those names are symbolic of the whole nation of Israel. The patriarch Jacob was later known as Israel, as you know. Verse 5, through you, God, we will push back our adversaries. Through your name, God, we will trample down those who rise up against us. For I will not trust in my bow, nor will my sword save me. Of course, the Israelites are going to have bows and they're going to have swords, but they're not going to put their ultimate trust in their weapons. And likewise, we trust in God for our health, but we go to the doctor. That kind of thing is meant here. Verse 7, you have saved us from our adversaries. And once again, most of the Psalms that we've gone through since the beginning of the book of Psalms have referred to enemies, which is very helpful for us today because we all have enemies. Devotionally is helpful to us. But you have saved us from our adversaries. You have put to shame those who hate us. Verse 8, in God we have boasted all day long, boasted about God winning the victory in God, not in their own flesh. And we will give thanks to your name forever. Thanks, why? For conquering our enemies. We go now to Psalms 44, verses 9 through 16. The first 8 verses were happy verses. Thank you, God, for whipping up on our enemies. Now, verses 9 through 16 are going to be sad verses, because the psalmist is going to say that Israel has been abandoned by God and scattered by their enemies. Starting with verse 9, yet you, God, have rejected us and brought us to dishonor, and do not go out with our armies. You cause us to turn back from the adversary, and those who hate us have taken spoil for themselves. You give us a sheep to be eaten, and have scattered us among the nations. You sell your people cheaply, and have not profited by their sale. You make us a reproach to our neighbors, a scoffing and a derision to those around us. You make us a byword among the nations, a laughingstock among the peoples. All day long my dishonor is before me, and my humiliation has overwhelmed me. Because of the voice of him who reproaches and reviles, because of the presence of the enemy and the avenger. Well, the obvious question we have here in verse 9, all of a sudden the psalmist says, yet you have rejected us. Why, after all the blessings and victories that were mentioned in verses 1 through 8, did all the blessing go sour all of a sudden in verse 9? The NIV Study Bible answers that question by saying there wasn't any particular reason why the psalmist says that God had rejected Israel. The psalmist does not mention any sin that might have caused the rejection anywhere in Psalms 44. As a matter of fact, as the NIV Study Bible points out, from what the psalmist could tell, Israel had been quite faithful to God. If we drop down to verses 17 through 18 in this same psalm, Psalm 44, we read this. All this has come upon us, but we have not forgotten you, and we have not dealt falsely with your covenant. Our heart is not turned back, and our steps have not deviated from your way. And so, says the NIV Study Bible, the psalmist is confused. Well, I don't know if he's confused. He's probably just putting himself in the same situation that Job did. We didn't do anything wrong. We're faithful to God, and now everything's gone bad. And Job learned the lesson that, hey, bad things happen to people who are innocent. He taught that lesson. Or at least they're innocent of something that would deserve such punishment. I think that's the best way to answer this, is that the psalmist here is in a Job situation. Can't understand why everything's going wrong for Israel. He can't understand because the enemies are winning, but he says in verse 17, we have not dealt falsely with your covenant. In verse 18, our heart has not turned back. Our steps have not deviated from your way. Well, there's another way to look at this. Maybe the psalmist was wrong in thinking Israel had been faithful. How about all the sins that Israel committed before on the Exodus on the way out? They almost got completely destroyed at the Golden Calf incident. How about when they refused to listen to the 2 spies, Joshua and Caleb, who said, let's go in and take the land. Oh, no, no, we need to wander for 38 years. So we could say the psalmist has been just a little bit overly optimistic about Israel's following God's path down in verses 17 and 18. But that seems kind of strange to me that he would say that in the light of all the horrible sins that Israel has committed in their history and appealing to Israel's righteousness in order to try to say, God, because of our righteousness, maybe you ought not to let these enemies win. That's just hard for me to believe. Could not the psalmist be referring to Israel's faithfulness during the captivity? After all, it was during the Babylonian captivity. When I say the captivity, I mean the Babylonian captivity of 586 BC. After all, it was during that captivity when the Israelites forever renounced idolatry. They gave it up. Here's what Adam Clark says, quote, we have not apostatized from thee. We have not fallen into idolatry. And this was strictly true. The charge of idolatry could never be brought against the Jewish nation from the time of the captivity with sufficient evidence to support it. So I think that makes more sense. We have to assume that the psalm was written late, long past the time of David, during the time of the Babylonian captivity. And he says, look, we're scattered. Now, here's some internal evidence that tends to make us think that the psalm was written late during the Babylonian captivity, or it could be the Assyrian captivity in 722 BC, for that matter, when the northern Israelites were taken by the Assyrians. Verse 11, you give us a sheep to be eaten and have scattered us among the nations. Well, that's what happened in 722 BC. For the northern Israelites and the Israelites were scattered. The southern Israelites were scattered in 586 BC. So that's what it sounds like. Now, in verse 12, the psalmist says that you, God, sell your people cheaply and have not profited by their sale. Now, what he means by that is that God is treating Israel like cheap slaves. Usually, if you buy a slave, you're going to be making a profit on that slave. But in this situation, the Israelites are so unvalued that when they're sold into slavery by God, God doesn't make a profit off of them. They're so cheap and so worthless. And you notice the psalmist is giving God the credit or discredit for letting the Israelites be scattered and taken into slavery. And of course, God is always the orchestrator of events in the Old Testament. I believe the Old Testament writers are very Calvinist, very Augustinian when they write. Now, of course, the psalmist is not blaming God for this. He's just asking a question. Why have you rejected us and let us be scattered? And why are you letting our enemies scoff and deride us? Why have you made us a byword among the nations, in verse 14, a laughingstock among the peoples? The us is the subject pronoun between verses 9 and 14, and then in verse 15, the psalmist switches to the singular, to the first person singular. All day long my dishonor is before me. Makes it personal. Why? Because he's humiliated, he's reproached, he's reviled, his enemy is there, and the avenger, I guess that means the person who is avenging something that the Israelites may have done before. So, on this difficult question of why does the psalmist in Psalm 44 switch to being happy about God winning all these victories for Israel, then switch to, oh my gosh, we're totally defeated and destroyed. He's probably in verses 1 through 8, talking about all the times that God did win victories for Israel. And then in verses 9 through 16, he's talking about how they had been carried into captivity. And in that captivity, they had remained faithful to the covenant. In my opinion, I don't believe the psalmist was trying to claim that Israel was faithful to God before the captivity, because obviously they were not. Read the book of Jeremiah, for example. Now, I said in verse 11 that this psalmist says that God had scattered the nation of Israel among the nations. Adam Clark says that the scattering referred to there was the Babylonian captivity, whereas Jameson Fawcett and Brown says it's not necessarily the Babylonian captivity. It could have been the Assyrian captivity in 722 BC. I've already said that, but I'll say it again. Now, this idea of God selling the Israelites into slavery, but doing it cheaply and not making a lot of money on the deal, well, let's put it this way. The idea of the Israelites being sold into slavery is stated in Judges 2, verse 14. The anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and he gave them into the hands of plunderers who plundered them, and he sold them into the hands of the enemies around them, so that they could no longer stand before their enemies. Well, there's the case where Israelites were sold into the hands of their enemies. That's during the time of the Judges, the Ammonites, the Moabites, and so forth, Philistines who were attacking Israel. Not necessarily the Assyrian and Babylonian captivity. Now in verse 14, the psalmist says that God has made the Israelites a laughingstock among the peoples. The KJV says God has made the Israelites a shaking of the head. The NIV translates it as the peoples shake their heads at us. Laughingstock is somewhat a less literal translation. Here's some other scriptures that talk about shaking the head at somebody. In derision. Psalms 22:7, the author of which is David. All who see me sneer at me. They separate with the lip. They wag the head. Shaking the head. In derision. Deuteronomy 28:37. This is in the chapter of curses in Deuteronomy 28. You shall become a horror, a proverb, and a taunt among all the people where the Lord drives you. Psalm 79:4. This is a psalm written by Asaph. We have become a reproach to our neighbors, a scoffing and derision to those around us. So this idea of Israel's reputation is an idea that's all through the Old Testament. In the Torah, too, Moses was concerned about that. He said, God, if you let us be destroyed because of our sin, what are the people going to say? They're going to say Yahweh is not a God who can take care of his people. And this idea is appealed to by penitent Israelites all the time. God, you know, we're being laughed at. This is not good because we're your people. Your name's being dragged down. The psalmist doesn't explicitly mention that idea here, but I'm sure that's the idea behind it. The main idea, though, is he's embarrassed and humiliated. We go now to Psalms 44, verses 17 through 22. The psalmist continues, all this has come upon us, but we have not forgotten you, and we have not dealt falsely with your covenant. Our heart is not turned back, and our steps have not deviated from your way. Yet you have crushed us in a place of jackals and covered us with the shadow of death. If we had forgotten the name of our God or extended our hands to a strange God, would not God find this out? For he knows the secrets of the heart. But for your sake, we are killed all day long. We are considered as sheep to be slaughtered. So, on the interpretation I have adopted, these verses are referring to the faithfulness of Israel to the covenant in the midst of their extremity and captivity. They held close to God's covenant, and they did, because they maintained their national identity. They still worshiped Yahweh when they came out. In fact, they worshiped Yahweh better in the case of the Babylonian captivity. They had gotten rid of all their idols. And so this is not a false boast when, in verse 18, the psalmist says, our heart is not turned back. Our steps have not deviated from your way. And then he says, yet you have crushed us in a place of jackals. That sounds like a wilderness, a desert. The King James has an interesting translation here. The King James has dragons. You have crushed us in a place of dragons. Dragons? Really? I didn't think dragons existed. I think unicorn is in the KJV too. For all of you KJV only advocates out there, explain that one to me. You have covered us with a shadow of death. Death is pictured as a shadow that's moving across a sunlit landscape and turns everything dark as the lights go out, as we die. He says in verse 20, if we had forgotten the name of our God or extended our hands to a strange God, would not God find this out? In other words, we believe in God so much, we know that he's going to know we're committing idolatry, so we don't do idolatry. Again, that must be true only during the Babylonian captivity, because before that, they were doing idolatry all over the place. And then he says in verse 22, but for your sake we are killed all day long. Now that's referring to either the Assyrian or Babylonian captivity. We are considered as sheep to be slaughtered. And that sounds awful familiar. That's Paul quoting Psalms 44, verse 22, and Romans 8:36. Just as it is written, for your sake we are being put to death all day long. We were considered as sheep to be slaughtered. And in that chapter, of course, God is telling the Christians that all things work together for those who love the Lord, and that God will deliver us all, the elect. He'll take care of us. So we go now to Psalms 44, verses 23 through 26, and we will finish this psalm. The psalmist continues, arouse yourself. Why do you sleep, O Lord? Awake. Do not reject us forever. Why do you hide your face and forget our affliction and our oppression? For our soul has sunk down into the dust. Our body cleaves to the earth. Rise up, be our help, and redeem us for the sake of your loving kindness. So this is a psalm of petition. We're in trouble. Where are you, God? Why do you hide your face? That's another example in the psalms of Deus absconditus, the hidden God. Where are you? How come you're taking so long to answer? We've talked about that in David's psalms. The reason, of course, that God does not answer the prayers of his children immediately is because he wants us to have faith and endurance. Faith is the essence of things not seen. If you see an instant answer all the time, then God becomes a genie in a bottle, and he is not going to do that. He says in verse 23, the psalmist does, why do you sleep, O Lord? He just finished saying that God will find everything out. He knows the secrets of the heart. And now he says, why are you sleeping? Well, that's speaking metaphorically. God, of course, can never sleep, but he's not answering the prayer, so it's like he's asleep. Now, the psalmist says in verse 24, why do you forget our affliction? Well, God didn't forget anything. God's God. He can't forget anything. As John Gill says, quote, he cannot, since they are engraven on the palms of his hands. The Israelites are engraved on the palms of God's hands. And a book of remembrance is written for them, nor the afflictions of his people. He can't forget the afflictions of his people. He knows their souls in adversity. He chooses them in the furnace of affliction. He makes all afflictions work together for good and delivers out of them. But because deliverance is not immediately wrought, and they sometimes continue long under their afflictions and oppressions, they seem to be forgotten by him. Well, that's naturally. How many times have we said, God, have you forgotten me down here? You know he hasn't, but it seems like it. Verse 25, the psalmist says, for our soul has sunk down into the dust. In other words, our soul is headed for the grave. We're about to die. Our body cleaves to the earth. The KJV has our belly cleaves to the earth. What does that mean? It means this person who stands for Israel is lying prostrate, his belly being placed against the ground. He's conquered. He's a suppliant asking for mercy from the enemy who's standing over him with a sword. Our body cleaves to the earth. And then in verse 26, the psalmist says to God, rise up, be our help. God is often addressed as a God who is indifferent, not acting for the suppliant, and who needs to arise. And this is done very reverently. It's not like it's, hey, God, you're shirking. You're not carrying out your job. That's not the attitude. It's, I don't know where you are, God, but please wake up and come get me. Come help me. Psalms 3:7, this is David authoring this psalm. Arise, O Lord, save me. O my God, you have smitten all my enemies on the cheek. You have shattered the teeth of the wicked. Arise, O Lord, David says, save me. Here's another psalm of David, Psalms 9:19. David says this, arise, O Lord, do not let man prevail. Let the nations be judged before you. And David also says in Psalms 13:1, how long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? He doesn't say arise there, but he's saying, where are you, God? Another example of Deus absconditus. I love that Latin phrase, the hidden God. Where are you, God? Need some help down here. Well, this psalm does not end on as happy a note as many of the psalms do. It instead ends with a prayer for help from affliction and oppression. And of course, the psalmist assumed that God was going to deliver him. Otherwise, he wouldn't have been writing this psalm. So I guess we could say that it still ends on a happy note. So with that, we are finished with Psalms 44. In our next audio, we will turn to Psalms 45, which I will entitle, Your Throne, O God, is Forever. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.